Welcome to Wire Talks, the Wire podcast. We've got a special episode today. You may notice that your usual host, Thomas Greer, is not piping through your cans right now. This is Louis Aboud. I manage the funds management side of Wire, running Wire Capital, our crypto fund. And we've got one of our portfolio projects in today for the second episode on the Wire Talks podcast, Seth Rubin from Market Protocol. Welcome, Seth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And so we're recording a special episode because they're nearing their mainnet launch, which I believe is scheduled for Monday the 24th. So depending on when this actually ends up coming out, I suspect that it might be a few days after the launch date. But we thought it would be timely to get them back in to chat about everything that they're doing because it's very exciting and I think really demonstrates the power of DeFi and what can be built on Ethereum. So without further ado, let's get into it. I think we should start with a broad overview, even though you've been on the podcast, talked about it before. You know, these stories always evolve. And, you know, with your mainnet launch coming up, let's just refresh people about how the protocol works, the different sort of components in it, and the sort of basics of the application and the different products that you can bring to market using the technology.
Sure. Sounds good. Yeah. Thanks again for having us. I think we were last on sometime in the fall. The architecture and the way that Market Protocol operates is high level similar, but I'll give a brief overview of what we're doing. So essentially, Market Protocol is a framework to create synthetic assets represented as tokens, as ERC-20 tokens on the Ethereum blockchain. We allow for users to create products that represent, say, crypto assets, traditional assets, or entirely net new assets, and they all benefit from decentralized infrastructure. So essentially what happens first is the asset is defined, and that asset could be something, for example, our initial product that we're launching is going to be DAI-denominated Bitcoin. That then is defined and deployed to the Ethereum blockchain, where it sits as a series of smart contracts. Anyone can deposit collateral and mint tokens that represent either long or short exposure. Those tokens then are deposited into your wallet. As ERC-20 tokens, they can trade on MPX, our exchange, or on any other exchange or application.
Right. So just to clarify, when you say synthetic assets, we're talking about, you gave the example of Bitcoin. So you don't necessarily need to secure Bitcoin using the Ethereum blockchain to provide exposure to Bitcoin, right? So explain how it is that you're able to provide that exposure.
Exactly. It's synthetic asset exposure. So basically, all relationships or all derivatives basically have two main pieces. The first piece is the reference asset. That's the asset that we are deriving value from. In this case, in this example, it's Bitcoin. Then we have the collateral or the collateral currency or token. In this case, it's DAI. So essentially what that means is we don't ever take custody of Bitcoin. We don't ever transact in Bitcoin. We basically just make or lose the collateral currency, DAI in this example. So essentially when a contract or a token reaches expiration or goes to settlement, we look to know what the price of Bitcoin is. And at that point, we then reconcile that in the collateral currency, DAI.
Right. So really, this is kind of like a smart contract that defines a bet between two parties. It's less about accessing that underlying asset and delivering it like a physically settled future.
Right. It's basically an agreement to transact at some point in the future based on a set of rules without actually taking custody of the underlying.
Right. And so because you don't need custody of the underlying, that really opens up the design space in terms of what you can build, right? So let's just take a step back and talk about the range of different products that can be produced with this technology, the range of exposure, just so people can understand what it is exactly that they could create using the protocol.
Sure. So one of the things that we thought about early is people might believe they need custody to gain price exposure, but at the end of the day, synthetic price exposure delivers that same price exposure that people want most of the time. So for example, like when I buy Bitcoin, it's not necessarily to spend Bitcoin. I may buy Bitcoin because I think it's going up. And I think that translates to a lot of assets that a lot of people are trading right now. So with Market Protocol, it allows for a user to gain exposure to Monero without figuring out how to custody or store Monero. It allows a trader to gain exposure to something like a stock index without actually buying the stocks or transacting in that index. So in the context of DeFi, in the context of blockchain, that means that we can remain on the Ethereum network and gain exposure to a cross-chain asset without worrying about how to custody that asset either in sort of a swap or either or in my own wallet. It also allows us to gain exposure to a traditional asset class like, say, gold or oil without actually having to figure out how to get that asset on chain. It also gives us the flexibility to define new assets that may not exist or trade anywhere. So I can now all of a sudden trade a smog index in Los Angeles, or I can create a crypto volatility index that allows for traders to gain exposure to something they may previously have either had a lot of difficulty accessing or may not have been accessible at all.
Interesting. Right. So before we get too deep into the weeds, why don't you tell us a bit about the team and your background and kind of how that's informed your design decisions with Market Protocol?
Sure. So we've been working on Market Protocol full time for quite some time now. We started in the middle of 2017. We've had a couple changes since then to, we think, design a better, more accessible product. My background is I was a derivatives trader and algorithmic market maker for about 13 years prior to co-founding Market Protocol and working full time. I've traded through all sorts of really interesting stuff. I traded through the financial crisis. I traded through flash crash. I've seen a lot of different scenarios where products have performed in ways that I think they should have or should not have. I've seen a lot of systemic issues that we've looked to address with Market Protocol. You know, I think that I've seen flash crash was particularly illuminating to see how different people respond to sort of a big systemic event. But overall, I think that we have a strong background in finance that allows us to really create a product that we think is redefining the way that people can access and trade not only traditional, but new products as well.
Right. So we'll get into the specifics around design decisions in a moment, but let's just talk briefly about what you're launching with and kind of how you think about the first products that you're going to introduce using the technology and how those might kind of evolve over the medium term.
Sure. So the initial product that we're launching is DAI versus Bitcoin. So essentially it's synthetic Bitcoin that's as an ERC-20 asset. It's tradable on any exchange that supports that standard. So the reason we're launching that is as we talk with different people in the industry, traders, market makers, exchanges, the sort of number one ask that we get in general is a way for people to easily gain short exposure to crypto assets. Bitcoin dollar is the most traded liquid pair, so we thought it only made sense to start there. The second thing that people really want in the space is an easy way to access leverage. Some people have access to leverage, but a lot of people don't. And actually, one of the things that's interesting in the crypto space, because all crypto trading primarily is spot crypto trading up till now, for the most part, people are posting full notional value, which really was something we wanted to address as that's not the most efficient use of capital. In terms of kind of what we're thinking about next, other assets that we want to launch and make accessible is beyond sort of being short crypto assets and trading with leverage, a lot of people also want access to traditional products. That can be commodities, that can be a stock index. One of the reasons I think that's particularly interesting is because we kind of begin to hit on the financial access narrative there, delivering the ability for people in a foreign or restricted jurisdiction to gain access to investment. And then one of the other things we've talked about briefly already here is that it also allows us to create specific crypto native type tools. So giving someone the ability to perhaps speculate or hedge mining difficulty or hash, I think provides some interesting points. One of the things that I think is interesting about that is that it allows for miners to actually put on a complete arbitrage. It allows for different people to hedge things that they could not previously hedge.
Right. Okay. Interesting. So you talked there about capital efficiency and leverage. At a high level, how does Market Protocol deliver leverage trading? And what are the kind of parameters around getting leverage on Market Protocol?
So we designed Market Protocol to basically be a closed system. So the notion of a margin call, a capital call, and a funding liquidation, those were things that we wanted to remove when we were originally architecting Market Protocol. So Market Protocol offers leverage in a way that I think is different than a lot of other projects. So essentially, when a contract, when a token is defined in Market Protocol's world prior to minting, that token has a price cap and a price floor. So to use numbers as an example, let's just say that Bitcoin and DAI, that relationship is trading at 10 right now. When that contract is defined, we basically have a price cap and a price floor of, in this example, let's say it's 50%. So that means that if the price of Bitcoin trades up to 15 or down to 5, that entire contract for all participants goes to settlement. And the benefit there is we can define the maximum downside for all participants at all times, and that allows us to fully collateralize this contract. So if I buy it at 10 and Louis sells it at 10, both of us at that point have 5 units of downside, and that's the amount of collateral that basically we're posting, or the cost of that token at that time. So each one of us right now have 5 units or 5 DAI of downside. So if Bitcoin DAI goes down to 5, the contract settles. If it goes up to 15, it settles. The interesting part there is both of us actually are levered 2-to-1. We both have 10 units of price exposure for 5 units of collateral. So high level, what this is doing is it's allowing us to maintain capital efficiencies, but it's removing some of the situations that we found to be challenging or systemically dangerous. So this contract always is fully solvent. There's no way to go negative on equity. There's no scenario where something like a socialized loss would come into play.
Right. Okay. So let's just talk about quickly what can go wrong when you don't have this kind of cap on risk, right? So, I mean, with traditional margin trading, you're basically posting some collateral, but it is possible for you to lose more money than you have posted, right? And in that situation, in the centralized world, you probably have to commence some kind of legal action with the counterparty to try and get paid. In crypto land, what might happen in that situation with both centralized exchanges and in the decentralized finance world?
Sure. So let's start with the centralized space. What we see there is this concept of socialized losses or an auto deleverage. The biggest places we tend to see it are on places like BitMEX, OKX. And essentially what happens is they enable traders to open leverage positions, which are basically positions where you put up, say, 20% of the position's value or 50% of the position's value. And then as that position moves against you, you have the option to bring that value back up to 50%. And if you don't, what tends to happen is that position will get liquidated to the market by the exchange. So that ensures that they're essentially not on the hook when your position runs out of equity. What tends to happen, though, in times of more volatile price action is that those positions tend to be liquidated more frequently for more users. So what can sometimes happen is those positions get liquidated to the market and they actually have no equity. They have negative equity. And what happens then is the exchange will socialize the loss amongst, it can depend, but typically amongst open position holders or sometimes across all open accounts across the entire exchange. So that really is a very sort of bad predatory practice and something that we were really surprised to see when we first came into the crypto space, because that doesn't exist in any other area. That's not something acceptable in the traditional space.
Right. And this isn't necessarily an edge case that hasn't occurred, right? Because we've seen it. I mean, we actually saw it quite recently with, I think it was
Clam on Poloniex.
Which is, I mean, I didn't really know that asset existed, but apparently they accepted Clams as collateral. So it wasn't even that you had to post BTC, you could actually post Clams, which is, I think, less common amongst exchanges that allow you to trade on margin. Usually the collateral they accept is Bitcoin and maybe Ether. Or USD.
Stablecoin, yeah.
Yeah. And so that was quite recent. People can look at what happened there. But there was also one, I think, with OKCoin and their futures that was pretty material as well.
It happens quite frequently. BitMEX has saw it happen on this run-up in Bitcoin a couple months ago. A lot of times they kind of band-aided in the sense that either there's an insurance fund to cover part of it, or the exchanges just sort of make do with it to basically avoid the PR. They just make people good. But fundamentally, it's also like a fundamental contract flaw. So one of the main reasons people use derivatives or futures in general is for risk management. And when you start socializing losses and you start creating unknown outcomes for hedging products, they will put companies or businesses out of business. So if United Airlines hedged their jet fuel and all of a sudden their hedge didn't perform the way that they expected it to, that company could be out of business. So I think that structurally it's actually a very bad design.
Right. And so you mentioned there that the BitMEX insurance fund, which has been gaining some attention recently because of the rate that it's been growing, right? Every time that there's a decent amount of volatility, the insurance fund tends to grow. So I don't think that it's actually been drawn down on in a major event yet, although I could be wrong. I'd have to look at a chart.
Well, the thing that BitMEX does is they auto deleverage, which is kind of the same thing in the sense that on the fly, the leverage implied by positions will change. So that means that people are making or losing amounts that they didn't expect to make.
Yes, sure. But I guess it's worth saying that in a situation where everybody is getting liquidated, you might see price movements going against those people even harder because you're basically getting everybody as a forced seller or buyer at the same time, right?
And that's where something like BitMEX Rect comes in,
yeah.
Right? Like,
but I think now it's that the insurance fund at BitMEX is at 28,000 Bitcoin, which is something like $277 million, right? So they've actually tried to solve this problem with a kind of, I guess you could call it brute force, but with the amount of open interest on BitMEX, you know, if we had some extreme price scenario, perhaps even that number would not be enough, right? I guess on BitMEX now, they're trading billions of dollars a day. So $277 million might not cut it in a flash crash scenario. But anyways, let's get back to market. So you're going to be launching with a minting platform that will allow users to create new position tokens. And you've also got MPX, which is basically a relayer that people can use to trade on the protocol. Can you just sort of briefly describe how the minting platform will work, what you get to play around with, and the role of MPX?
Sure. Yeah. So basically, we're launching two pieces of infrastructure coming up on Monday. The first being MPX, which is Market Protocol Exchange. It's a 0x relayer. The point of MPX is it's essentially our tasting room. It's the place where someone can first view what we're doing in terms of position tokens and trade them. It may not ultimately be the venue you end up trading primarily on, but we wanted to make sure that we had sort of that initial venue that allows for people to get started. It's designed to support our overall business. And what we're doing is we're in the business of minting position tokens. And these position tokens, as we mentioned before, they can trade on our exchange or any other exchange or venue. So the second thing we're launching is our minting platform, which is a dApp that interacts with our market protocol smart contracts that allow for anyone, could be a market maker or could be a trader, to mint these position tokens that represent synthetic asset exposure.
Right. And so what parameters can you set within the minting platform?
So essentially, the first few tokens that we're creating for minting, in this case, DAI versus Bitcoin, we're defining the parameters to ensure that we kind of are designing or sort of high quality products are entering the marketplace. Initially, when we sort of spec'd and thought about market protocol, we were thinking of sort of this very blank canvas, anyone can mint or create anything. Our concern with that model was inevitably people will create or mint tokens that may not make the most sense, which would make it difficult for people to identify what tokens they want to trade and how to actually just get the exposure that they wanted. So for now, we're following kind of a, I would say maybe like a maker model, maker DAO model, where we're defining the spec, we're defining the rules. They're visible. They allow for anyone to see how they work. And then anyone who wants to can mint the defined contract. So it's very similar to, you know, MakerDAO has defined DAI. They put it on the blockchain. And then anyone who wants to can deposit Ethereum and receive back DAI. With Market Protocol, anyone can see what this DAI Bitcoin contract is. They can understand the rules. They understand when it expires. They understand how it prices. And then if they, you know, want to then mint contracts or mint tokens, they can deposit collateral and receive back tokens.
Interesting. So is there a future where users will be able to participate in the defining of new markets, not just in terms of parameters for, say, a DAI Bitcoin market, but also other asset pairs settled by different oracles?
Sure. So we have designed market protocol to be very flexible. So at the end of the day, all this is a contract container that allows for some number of participants to set a set of rules, deposit collateral, and never have to talk to or see each other again, and trust that this will deliver according to those rules. So in the future, what we definitely want to do is to engage our community, to engage users, to understand what products we can create and how we can design those products to deliver the best experience. So I think we have a good idea of what people want to see and trade from talking to them. I think we also have kind of a roadmap in the marketplace in the sense that we can see some of the most liquid products, both in the crypto space and in the traditional space, as the products that people are currently trading. So that gives us a good idea of things that we can make accessible. In terms of products that are net new, again, like sort of a, say, a crypto index, some of the other things we've talked about, that's really something that we're looking for community feedback to help define.
Interesting. Okay. So there is a native token within the system of which Wire Capital is a holder or future holder. What will the role of the MK token be at launch?
Right. So the MKT token at launch will be used as a fee discount token. So MPX, our relayer, currently has no fees on the exchange. The market protocol minting platform will charge a fee for minting tokens. The fee can be paid in the collateral currency, or that fee can be paid in the MKT token. If the fee is paid in the MKT token, users will receive a fee reduction. The other thing the MKT token is going to be used for at launch will be for basically incentivizing and educating new users to the platform. So we're using the MKT token to walk people through onboarding, to give them a way to mint tokens for free at launch, to also incentivize trading. So essentially, the token will be used to educate and integrate new users.
Interesting. And so within the token economic space, there's a wide range of behaviors that you can incentivize using tokens. Thinking down the track more, when we've seen how market protocol develops, issues around oracles and settlement, you know, what can the token be possibly used for, integrated into in the future to ensure a smooth operation of the system?
Yeah, so I think that one of the best uses for a token in general is to create this feedback loop between stakeholders and delivering value to the network. So speaking broadly, I think that systems that incentivize stakeholders to make good decisions that allow for value to accrue is how you want to use a token. So for something like market protocol, using the native token to deal with settlement disputes, to deal with settlement values and help in arbitration are ways that we think really do create this feedback loop that incentivizes sort of good behavior to the whole network.
Right. And I've noticed that 0x, for example, have introduced, call it, market making incentives that are based on their token. You're a professional market maker for a number of years. What do you think about those kind of mechanisms? And is that something that you would consider for market protocol?
I think that incentivizing market makers beyond straight like payments or stipends is important to building a sustainable program. So I think that what they're doing is definitely a step in the right direction. For something like market protocol, also, I guess, very similar to 0x, is we have a network or protocol level incentive for success. Like, we don't really need any one particular venue to, I mean, it would be great if all venues were successful, but just to even use MPX as an example, like, we'd love for MPX to be successful, but it's okay if it isn't. Really, our goal is to use the MKT token to create protocol level incentives for good behavior, and that can fall under something like providing liquidity.
Interesting. So how do you think about building liquidity around the launch of the protocol bringing on market makers. What will that look like for the BTC DAI pair and the kind of the first few products that you bring out? Because this has been an issue, I guess you could say, for all DeFi protocols, is bootstrapping liquidity. Granted, we've seen, I think, a bit more life in the various systems that are out there at the moment, but it's definitely an issue, especially for like the trading products out there.
Yeah, I think that building liquidity is critically important. I think that, you know, it starts with traditional market makers. We have engaged and are very happy with our existing market makers who are providing liquidity initially on MPX. I think that it all starts there. You know, I think one of the interesting things in general of the space, period, is that people are interested in trying out new things. So I think that organic growth in the space, particularly in the DeFi space, is one of the ways that we'll see organic usage. I think that with Market Protocol, we're delivering, I would say, some utility that doesn't quite exist. And I think that that's a really interesting point in a way that I see some of our liquidity naturally accruing. So, for example, that now all of a sudden there are ERC-20 only exchanges that can deliver cross-chain assets. I think that that's an important thing to giving their users an opportunity. Further, I think that the way that we educate and engage users on the benefits of our product will help to also foster some native utility liquidity. The other thing that I think that's important to gaining liquidity at the protocol level, not just on MPX, is sort of putting on really at the highest level, traders and investors care about really two different things. The first thing being, how can I make more money? And the second thing being, how can I protect the money that I have? So if you deliver an answer to one or both of those questions, people are going to figure out how to use your product and how to access your product. So I was speaking with someone who's been helping us sort of with some of the initial launch stuff on MPX and the initial minting platform. And one of the things that he said to me is that if you give traders a way to access leverage and a way to make more money using that leverage, they're going to figure out and use your product, which I think is an interesting, very simple way to say it.
Mm, interesting. And so how do you think about oracles and settlement at a high level? It sounds like you've taken a relatively agnostic approach. You're effectively defining the oracles in the first products. Will there be a future where any oracle can be baked in? And, you know, how do you think about kind of opening up the protocol to different forms of oracles?
Yeah. So the way that we think about oracles and settlement is it's kind of interesting. The space has kind of moved around quite a bit on oracles. First, people liked oracles, then people didn't like oracles. And I think that we're kind of in a space where people think about oracles are okay, but there's still a problem with them. The way that I think about oracles is oracles are right and okay. A centralized oracle, I'll even define that, is right 99% of the time. And that's fine because I think that delivers a superior UX to a lot of the suggestions and ways people are thinking about it now. What's important is that for that 1% of time where that oracle doesn't work, we need a way to deal with that. So that's kind of, in general, the overall way we think about oracles. For the initial implementation of Market Protocol, we've written our own oracle. It's using CoinCap, which is a shapeshift product, to fetch the price of a 70 exchange Bitcoin index. And that's what we'll be using initially for our oracle settlement. We design Market Protocol, though, to be essentially, as Louis said, oracle agnostic. So one of our partners, for example, is Chainlink. You know, Chainlink, I think, is really a core piece of infrastructure that allows for us to basically settle derivative contracts to any data source or anything we want by using their ecosystem and their network of nodes and settlers. So using something like Chainlink allows us then to decentralize that oracle or that settlement value. So essentially, at the highest level, any oracle can be used for settlement. It just really depends on how that contract is defined.
Right. And in the future, if users are participating in the creation of new markets, you know, a key component of that process will be oracle selection. Is there anything that, you know, obviously it's extremely early and there are a bunch of different models out there for how oracles should be built and how the incentives around them should work. But do you think it's possible for users to sort of assess oracles and their quality? How is it that users can sort of do due diligence on the data feeds that are getting used to settle these contracts?
Yeah, I think that in general, as the space matures, we're going to see a couple models being better or worse. And really what we're committed to delivering the best product and the best UX. That's always kind of my concern with at least some of the products that, that may be out there now, or some of the ways that we're thinking about it, is we don't want to run into a scenario where an Oracle Deliver is almost like a perpetual settlement because we continue to iterate through dispute resolution. So I think that really what's important is that we can use an Oracle solution that works best for the product that we're offering.
Right. So I guess, you know, something like Augur, you've seen some dispute processes be dragged out over. Is that kind of what you're referring to?
I don't want to mention any projects by name, but it's possible that some models can sort of enter into almost a perpetual settlement.
Right. Okay. And by a perpetual settlement, you mean basically where the dispute resolution process takes a long time.
Correct. I think that the Oracle implementation and the time to resolution is a very important piece of the UX, which is why, personally, I don't think that it's bad to use a centralized Oracle 99% of the time, because it delivers a better experience to users 99% of the time. It's just Oracles don't even have to be malicious. Like, the power could go out, or, you know, something returns a null value. And that requires us, because this is a decentralized solution, to have a backup plan.
Interesting. Okay. So, you know, you described before how the kind of exposure caps and leverage work on Market Protocol. And that introduces a few kind of nuances around the UX for the position tokens. So what do you think that users need to kind of digest and understand when trading market position tokens, given they're a new product for a lot of people? You know, how should they think about pricing, and how can they kind of come to understand the intrinsic value of these assets when they're trading on exchanges?
Yeah, so in general, we think that it's really important that people spend some time understanding how these products price. They don't price directly on top of, say, the spot relationship, in this case, Bitcoin, because of the price cap and price floor. So we've written a number of different blog posts called MP Explained, which we go through a number of different sort of payoff structures and graphs and price these tokens in a way that we hope is easy to follow. I'd love for people to give me feedback if it doesn't make sense. But essentially, there's a little education that goes around trading these products. When I first started my trading career, I went through an interview, and basically the question was, you think Bitcoin's worth a dollar, but Louis's willing to sell you as many as you want at 50 cents. Like, what do you do? And the answer isn't buy as many as he's willing to sell you, because you assume that you've kind of made an error, or the market's efficient, and there's actually a problem. So what people may notice initially when they go on MP Exchange is that these don't price directly on top of Bitcoin. So it's not an opportunity to buy a bunch of really cheap Bitcoin exposure. It's an opportunity to learn how they're priced. So that's definitely something that is important to us. And I think that one of the UX challenges with what we've designed, we think the trade-off is a better, safer product, but we understand that there's definitely some pricing that needs to go around there. And I think that, just to wrap that up real quick, like, traditionally, like, there's products that trade that are like 3x leverage short the S&P. They trade on, it's like an ETF or futures like product. It trades in traditional exchanges. That thing will trade at something like 20. And people just understand that it's a different product, and it prices differently, but it's deriving value from the S&P. And I think that's an important thing just to kind of realize as you look at what we're doing with Market Protocol.
Right. And so I guess on the point of leverage and margining and collateral, you know, you kind of alluded to it before, but I'd like to get it into a bit more detail. So how does the kind of the collateral pool and all of that work? It kind of feels like each position token doesn't really have a particular counterparty, right? And that everything is sort of pulled together. So if you could just kind of help users understand that, what does that sort of look like?
Sure. So again, Market Protocol, right, has position tokens that are minted. These position tokens are minted as pairs. So when someone deposits collateral into the smart contract to mint a pair of position tokens, the position tokens don't have a price. There's just a price for minting both the long and the short. This means that as the price of Bitcoin moves, the price to mint position tokens is always the same. It's always the price cap minus the price floor. And that's illustrated again on some of the MP exchange documents that we've released. But the point is that these tokens, they don't have a price. Essentially, when you sell one token, the price of the other token is implied. So if I have a long and a short token, I have a market neutral position. If I sell a long token out, I'm left short. If I have a long and a short and I sell a short, I'm left long. We don't necessarily expect everyone to mint position tokens. It's totally possible and expected that most people just go on exchange and buy the exposure that they want. The benefit of that, though, is they know that that token is always fully collateralized. There's no credit risk with the counterparty. There's no funding shortfall that's possible. All outstanding tokens are fully collateralized at all times, regardless of who the owner is, by the collateral pool. So in a sense, it's kind of minted against the collateral pool. And then that means there's no credit risk. There's no solvency issue.
Right. And so when you have credit risk in a DeFi protocol, that all has to be managed, right? Because, you know, when you're talking about transactions on Ethereum, it's difficult to automate certain actions. And third parties need to come in to basically proactively manage the risk of these systems. So it's a common theme amongst, you know, MakerDAO or Compound or DYDX, where once a position becomes too risky or under-collateralized, a third party has to come in and basically manage that risk by liquidating the remaining collateral, and there's some kind of an incentive to encourage them to do that. And so what are the sort of risks that these protocols assume when they use that approach?
Yeah, so for me, that approach concerns me a lot. And just to mention some of the stuff we talked about at the beginning is it creates a lot of systemic risks. We've seen those kinds of things break down in the traditional centralized derivative space. You know, again, using flash crash as an example. When volatility goes up and these systems get stressed, more people are transacting, and that's a problem in the traditional space. What we're going to see, and my concern with all these models right now in the DeFi space, is they create systemic danger, both from the pricing side, financial risks, but they're also going to pose a lot of technical risks. So essentially, all these systems of liquidating undersolvent positions, they all work fine in a vacuum and they all work fine in an orderly sell-off. But the moment we really need these tools to all work together, there's going to be an issue when all the correlations, and I think we're addressing some of this stuff. So like, you know, something like multi-collateral DAI, I think addresses some of this, for example. But what we're still going to see is correlations go to one in a time of extreme volatility. We're also going to see that the Ethereum blockchain or other blockchains are going to have considerable network congestion, and that's going to pose another technical risk. And I think that those are some of the problems with the current framework. One of the things that Louis brought up was managing these positions. And that is really kind of like a interesting cost. That's not exactly a financial cost, but it's a time or resource cost. And when you have to, really what we're seeing is kind of ironic or interesting in the space is people are not interested in paying that time or resource cost. And what they're doing is over collateralizing their positions. So if you look on something like LoanScan or some other collateralization metric, you'll see that a lot of the existing DeFi projects are like 3x, 4x, 5x over collateralized right now, which is kind of ironic because there are a lot of them are touted as sort of leverage or products that allow you to use less collateral. So I think that the way that we're addressing it is important, because I think that a lot of the existing incentives kind of create an environment that maybe isn't as expected.
Right. And so, but there is a trade-off here. So there is a somewhat of a UX cost around doing things your way, because when you have these caps on the sort of up and downside of a position token, it means that if you reach the cap and you want to maintain that exposure, you're going to have to do something, right? So how do you think about that UX issue and how that might be able to be solved in the future?
Yeah, I do think that creates a UX issue in the sense that it's a new product. But I think that in terms of doing something like that is something that we see, again, pretty often in the traditional financial space, is you see people in options talk, they roll up and down strike, or in futures, what they'll do is they roll expiration. So it's not uncommon for people to roll positions. So that has been a concern that people bring up, is that, you know, what if I want continuous price exposure? You're only offering it to a price cap. And the way that we would address that, I think, in the future would be, you can basically have either someone build an application on top of these tokens that abstract away that rolling of price, or you'll see market makers basically present, you know, say, for example, we have a contract that had a price cap of $10,000 in Bitcoin right now, and we may have hit that on the podcast or not, but essentially, what someone could do is have a new contract that automatically facilitates this roll. So the next contract might have a price cap of 15,000, and the trader could automatically be rolled into that new contract with still the same benefits of capped exposure, capped downside, and guaranteed solvency. So I do think that that could be a UX challenge. It's certainly something that's on our radar, and certainly though something we think is addressable.
So one of the narratives that's around DeFi that you kind of alluded to before was this concept of growing access to financial products using Ethereum, because it has this benefit of really putting all of this liquidity onto one piece of technology that's accessible with a simple internet connection. You don't need advanced traditional financial infrastructure to get access to quasi-US denominated savings, or, you know, higher quality synthetic investment products that might not be available in emerging markets. How do you think about building distribution to these net new users that might be able to access products like this for the first time?
Yeah, so I think that one of the really cool things about crypto assets in general, right, is that accessible, unstoppable property of them that allows for someone in any location with their cell phone or their computer to receive, send, and transact in those crypto assets. So we think that's really cool. And delivering financial access to underserved markets, I think, makes a lot of sense. That's something that we're excited about with Market Protocol. So, for example, in the Philippines, it's difficult for an individual or even a more professional institutional investor to gain access to something like high quality US investment. So even something that I think is pretty mundane, like a US T-bill or something, is not really a product that they can access there. So getting listed, getting access to users on exchanges in restricted jurisdictions or geographies like that to deliver traditional assets, we think is really exciting. So, you know, for example, in, say, Venezuela, now someone can gain access not only to a reserve currency, they can all of a sudden access high quality US investment for, I don't know, retirement or something, for example.
And so I guess we have to talk about the regulatory landscape, because it is always a hot button issue in crypto. I think people tend to perhaps overemphasize the relevance of the US regulations for DeFi, because it is possible to do things outside of America, right? So how do you think about the regulatory landscape both within the US? You know, what can you do theoretically here? So what opportunities are there to sort of test out these technologies in other jurisdictions?
Sure. So very quickly, in the United States, I think there's probably two buckets products like this can fall under. The first being, if the reference asset is something that is a security, like a single stock, for example, I think that comes under the SEC jurisdiction and probably requires the exchange to have some licensing. In terms of other products that are commodities, things like a stock index, gold, Bitcoin, those would fall under the CFTC umbrella. Again, this is just sort of my understanding, and would be regulated, as I said, under the CFTC, and may or may not have different licensing requirements. Market Protocol, our initial approach is we are launching, like I've seen a lot of products, initially outside of the United States. We're restricting our platform to ex-US and ex a few other jurisdictions. And we're doing that primarily because we want to focus on building the best product we can. And that's something that we're going to be doing initially as we focus on how can we implement Market Protocol, how can we really focus on what we're doing without basically dealing with the US regulatory framework initially. In parallel, though, we do expect to basically continue focusing on how we can be compliant in the United States.
Right. Interesting. And so are there, you have a sort of number of partnerships listed on your website. You've got Maker up there and Chainlink and a few others. What opportunities do you have, or what are you sort of seeking in partnerships? What different sort of adjacent projects do you think important or interesting for Market Protocol, and how can those sort of relationships grow over time to be mutually beneficial?
Sure. So I think that with Market Protocol, we kind of see a couple different things that are really important to us. You know, we like DAI as a stablecoin. We think that denominating our relationships in DAI makes the most sense. That's something we're excited about. As mentioned before, Chainlink, I think, really addresses kind of a core issue in the space and allows us to generate settlement data in a decentralized way for lots and lots of different products. So I think that that's really exciting. We look forward to how we can use that to run Chainlink settled Market Protocol contracts. Other things that I think are issues in the space, things that we think we could benefit from is on the UX side, how we can deliver our traders, our users, an easier, better experience. One of the things that I think that we've definitely seen in general is people kind of getting uninterested in different products that are tough to use. So we're looking for partners that can help our users understand or use what we're doing better.
And I guess a big piece of that aspect of it would be trading venues, right? So where position tokens might trade and how trading venues can build a UX that really suits this kind of product, right?
Yeah, I think that that's very accurate as well. A way for Market Protocol, obviously, to grow is to be listed on different exchanges and different venues. So in the near term, we hope to be coming online in two different decentralized venues. Again, I think one of the initial core use cases of Market Protocol is that it allows for an ERC-20 native platform or exchange to immediately gain exposure to cross-chain assets. So that's something that we're excited for right away. One of the other things we mentioned here is delivering traditional asset exposure to geographies that may not have it. So that's definitely something we have on our list right now.
And so there are a number of other projects that they're either sort of directly doing something that's similar to what you guys are doing, or the primitives of the system that's being built can kind of do similar things, I guess, is one way of describing perhaps how what you do is similar to Augur, right? So Augur's not necessarily built from the ground up to provide, you know, trading of different derivatives, but in a way it can be used to provide that sort of exposure. How do you think about the different projects out there? I mean, we talked about the difference in the way collateral margining and risk is managed, but you know, how do you think about market sort of position in that broader landscape?
Yeah, I think that at the end of the day, I mean, you brought up Augur, but at the end of the day, all a derivatives market is, all a financial market is a prediction market. It's an expectancy of something's future value. So I think that we are kind of similar there. Where Market Protocol really differentiates from products on the market is either the asset exposure that we can deliver. So some projects are limited to perhaps an ERC-20 only assets, or you know, how we deliver that asset exposure. I think that creating a product that offers users defined downside, that offers them accessible leverage, is really kind of how we look at our differentiation. We've designed a system that is designed as a way to provide capital efficiencies, but also as a way to decentralize and make safer the way margin and leverage works. Our contracts are designed to be entirely fungible. So we don't have kind of one-off arrangements with different lenders or counterparties. We don't have borrow rates or anything else. So we think that all of that will create a more fungible, more liquid product at an ecosystem level.
And so the launch is going to occur next week, which will probably be the same week this podcast comes out. You've got MPX, which is a 0x relayer where users can come and trade. You've got the minting platform. How do they find these things?
Yeah, so our website is marketprotocol.io. The exchange is mpexchange.io. Directly integrated into the exchange is the minting platform. We make it easy to mint or redeem position tokens.
Right, and so if a user wants to participate, they can basically come to, let's start with the minting platform, even though your average user might not necessarily use it. It might be a tool, I guess, more for market makers, but What would they do? They would come to the minting platform with some DAI and mint long and short tokens, and then basically How do they sort of go through this process?
Right. So essentially what someone would do is they would come up to, when they first are greeted with MP Exchange, you'll create an account, you'll verify your email. As part of that process, we're going to give you some MKT tokens. These MKT tokens will then cover the cost of minting your first position. What you can do then is you deposit. We have an interface, a dApp that allows for minting. It'll tell you what you're minting, what you'll receive back, how much collateral is required to mint those positions. If everything looks good, you approve the transaction, you deposit collateral into the smart contract and receive back long and short position tokens directly into your wallet. At that point, you can do nothing, or you can go trade on MP Exchange, or you can trade them to whoever you want.
And so will there be a particular amount of leverage implied by these Bitcoin contracts?
The leverage is defined by, initially when you enter into a position, you have a long and a short on the minting platform. And what that means is at that point, you're market neutral. When you transact in a specific token, a long or a short, that leverage will be defined by the price at which you transact. So in the example we had given before, if Bitcoin DAI is trading at 10 with a price floor of 5, if Louis buys a long, he's going to pay 5 for it because that's his maximum downside. And he has 10 units of price exposure. So that means he has 2x leverage at that instant. The amount of leverage implied by the position will actually change depending on where you enter that position.
And so users will be able to trade position tokens either they've minted or that other people have posted orders on MPX, and then they'll basically have that position token in their wallet.
Correct, right. So everything is non-custodial. You're basically trading, I think as 0x puts it, wallet to wallet. So there's no custody of your assets on exchange. It remains in your wallet.
And so it will remain in there until the contract settles or expires, and then what do they do?
Right. So at settlement, the position token is basically now turns into an IOU that allows for redemption from the collateral pool. So if your long position is worth 3 DAI at expiration, then through the dApp, you basically can redeem that long position for a return of collateral.
Right. So a user will be able to come onto MPX. Let's say they want to get levered long some Bitcoin. They can buy some long position tokens. And they can basically sit on them. Eventually, the contract's going to expire. And after it's expired, presumably, they have until eternity, basically, to come and collect on the value of that contract.
Right. And the other thing they could do, obviously, is just trade out of that position. If it went up in value and they wanted to be out of it, they could trade out of that just like any other asset.
Right. Okay. And so, will they be able to trade expired tokens on MPX?
Once a token is expired, there's no real value change. So there's not a huge incentive to actually trade it. You could technically trade expired tokens, but their value is set. So I'm not sure why you would do that because they could just be redeemed directly for a return of collateral.
Yeah, right. Makes sense. All right, Seth. Well, thanks for coming back on. Certainly exciting times, and I'm keen to see how the product gets traction. You know, we've seen some of these other sort of similar products like DYDX really start to ramp up, given we're in a bull market again, and everyone seems particularly interested in leverage trading. So I hope it all goes really well. Thanks for coming back on.
Great. Thanks very much for having me. I'm happy to be here again. Thanks.
So, if people want to learn more about Market Protocol, you can go to marketprotocol.io and have a read of their different materials there. They've also got a blog on Medium, which has an explanation around how these assets price. I think it's especially important that people have a look and digest what exactly it is that they're buying if they're going to trade these assets.
Thanks, guys.